Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Shankar Mitra. Some of you know me, maybe. I know some of you as well, so that's good. So why don't we start, before the children go to their classes, we'll start with the mantras, and we do the mantras before the children go because the children have pure hearts, so there's more power, and we do it with them. So that's part of the theory. So let's do, on page 183, we'll do Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. Shakyamuni Buddha is our historical Buddha. Jayata Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. Jayata Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. Jayata Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. And then let's turn to page 34, and we'll do the four immeasurables in English only. And the reason we're not doing the Tibetan is because the Tibetan, this line is too long to fit the tune that we normally do. Oh, it's on the next page? Wait a minute, which next page? Page what?
Page 37 near the bottom.
Oh, okay. So we'll do it in Tibetan then as well. All right, perfect. Okay, so let's do in English first. May all sentient beings have happiness and the cause of happiness. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and the cause of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then we'll do it in Tibetan. Bottom of page 37. Four immeasurables. Sem chen tam che de wadang de we gyudang den par gyuchi du. And then we'll do Chenrezig, which is the Buddha of Compassion, Chenrezig's mantra, and then Green Tara's mantra. So Chenrezig's mantra 8 times, and Green Tara's mantra 7 times. Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. And can someone start the Tara mantra? I know a different tune, so. Dure soha, om tari tu tari dure soha. 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 So the children can now go to their classes. Let's see, hang on. I'm going to keep this page open so I know what to start the dedication prayers. Okay. So we'll start with a short meditation. How many of you have not been here before or have not meditated or sat before? Okay. So I'll then say a few words. And we'll do the meditation for maybe 10 minutes. And if you are doing it for the first time, then it might be a little difficult to keep your concentration. So the instructions are to, when you feel you're getting tired, your mind is getting tired, that is, to take a break. So you can stay in your seat, but relax your mind for a couple of minutes, and then you can start again. So that way, you make multiple segments out of, you know, the 10 minutes, right? So Geshe-la's instructions for doing meditation. So meditation always has to have an object, right? So on which we set our concentration or on our mind, the object of our meditation. So in this case, that'll be our breath. And so essentially all we're doing is setting our minds in the breath by focusing on its sensation, maybe as the breath goes in and out, as the tummy moves in and out, as the sensation of the tip of the nostril, however, whatever works for you. If that doesn't work, you can count the breaths, right? So you can count up to 21, and you can't count with your fingers or toes, or you speak. Or you can't count it by saying 1, 2, under your breath. You can't do that either. You have to do it in your mind, and if you lose track, you've got to start with 1. So that's kind of how it works. So what we'll do is we'll start with the counting, if you will, in our minds, and then we'll continue, right? So if you want to continue counting, you're welcome to count on up, or you can just set your mind on the breath and just stay in, you know, in equipoise, right? Most important thing is to have our back straight, but with a natural curvature, right? I mean, I'm not going to go over the seven posture of the Vajra, you know, the Vajra posture, etc. But just the back is the most important thing, and to keep the natural curvature, so the winds and energies can flow properly in our channels. Okay. So we start with an out breath. Then on the in breath. 1, 2, like that. up to 21, if you can. If thoughts come, you can just observe them or just notice them, and then you just let them go by. You don't have to follow them. So, so when I was thinking about, you know, what to think about, what to talk about this morning, what came to me is, you know, some of you may not, you know, may not be aware, but a great lama, a great master, passed away week ago Friday, Chödön Rinpoche. Some of you may be fortunate enough to have been here when he came in 2007. 2007, yeah, because I had moved here from California in 2006. So, yeah. And I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about his life. And I wanted to read to you a couple of pages of his death, the last few months of his life, that his attendant wrote a letter, you know, to his students, like me and others, about the last few months of his life. And it's really inspiring to hear about these great beings, because we kind of see them in, we kind of see them in the abstract sometimes, and it's interesting to see how they really conduct themselves, you know, because through their outer life, through our, what we see in their outer life, we can kind of gauge what their inner life must be like, right? So, and Chödön Rinpoche, anyway, we'll go in there. So Chödön Rinpoche, he was one of the last remaining old masters, you know, masters from old Tibet, if you will. There's only a few of them now still who are in the West. One is Kenpo Karta Rinpoche in upstate New York, who is in the Kagyu tradition. He's like 92. He comes to Chapel Hill like once a year. So I live in Chapel Hill, so I get to see him. But in any case, so Chödön Rinpoche, he was born in like early 1920s, and he finished most of his studies, you know, at Sarajie in Tibet, you know, the Sarajie Monastery in Tibet. And he was, you know, already at the time he was recognized a great, great master, right? Great teacher. And, you know, his teacher, for example, was Trijang Rinpoche, who, if you know The Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, right? That book that we talk about, which is a seminal text in our tradition. So The Liberation in the Palm of Our Hand was actually the teachings of Pabongka Rinpoche in the, like around 1926 or something. He gave a 26-day retreat, right? And so those are transcriptions of that retreat by Trijang Rinpoche. And Trijang Rinpoche actually is the one who wrote the book. The Liberation of Palm of Our Hand, actually his notes from Pabongka Rinpoche's teachings in 1926. So Trijang Rinpoche was Chödön Rinpoche's teacher, and Trijang Rinpoche actually was also His Holiness Dalai Lama's, one of his tutors. But anyway, so Chödön Rinpoche was a great master at the time already, and he actually happened to be His Holiness's debate examiner. Like when His Holiness Dalai Lama was taking his examinations for his Geshe degree, which I don't think he finished because, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, because the Chinese invaded before he could finish. But in any case, when he was taking his examinations for his Geshe degree, Chödön Rinpoche was one of his debate examiners, right? He was the one His Holiness had to debate against on the two truths. That was a subject that, you know, so they had to debate on. And so when the Chinese invaded, as you know, in 1959, many hundreds of thousands of Tibetans and monks and nuns left. But Chödön Rinpoche, even though he was, you know, Chödön Rinpoche remained. He stayed in Tibet. And part of the reason was that, even though he was, you know, the Chinese, of course, had extra special, treatment, I guess, for the recognized lamas, right? Rinpoche's, Tulku's, so forth and so on, people who were in the Tibetan government at the time. So they had special treatment for them. But Chodron Rinpoche, although he was a recognized incarnation, he didn't live like other recognized incarnations. Because usually a recognized incarnation, you know, in the monastery, they have their own house. They have their own set of, you know, like staff, attendants, so forth and so on. But Chodron Rinpoche just kind of lived among the ordinary monks, right? So he didn't have, you know, special stuff, accoutrement, I guess, whatever. And so the Chinese kind of, you know, like let him be a little bit, you know. But they didn't separate him out, you know, from the others and so forth and so on. So he stayed behind, but of course things got worse. So the Chinese put him under house arrest. So he was in house arrest. Chodron Rinpoche was in house arrest for 19 years. And he would live in his cousin's house in Lhasa. And he lived in one room for 19 years. He was essentially in solitary confinement. I mean, he was not quite house arrest. It's really solitary confinement. He was in this one room. Actually, his attendant, later when he went to Tibet, his attendant went to Tibet and saw the house and saw the room. He basically said it was one room. It had a door. It had a little vent above the door for air to come through. And there were no windows. And it was so dark that you had to, when you walked in, you kind of had to wait a while for your eyes to acclimate, eyes to get used to the dark, you know, so you could actually make out shapes. Right? So it was like that. So he was in that room for 19 years. There was a guy who would come in twice a day, you know, bring him food and clean out the bedpan and so forth and so on. The Chinese, of course, you were not allowed to do any pujas or rituals, right? Because that was, you know, you would be immediately be hauled off. So he didn't have anything with him. He didn't have any books. He didn't have any implements, you know, to do his practices, you know, the Dorje bell, all the other things, you know, that you use, altar statues. He didn't have anything, basically a bare room and a bed. So he sat on the bed and he meditated during the day and he slept on the bed at night. And once a month they would change the sheets. That's how it worked. And the Chinese would come and visit him about two or three times a day to make sure that he wasn't doing any pujas. And so he pretended to sleep for 19 years. That's what he said. He pretended he was asleep. And he had a heart condition. So he kind of was able to kind of, like for example, when the Chinese would make all the monks denounce the Dalai Lama, you know, they would have to go to special re-education, you know, to denounce the Dalai Lama and so forth and so on. So he could kind of pretend that he was sick, you know, because he had his heart condition. They would take his pulse and, you know, it would be constantly racing. So they would think, oh, he's not well. So they would, you know, he wouldn't have to do all those things, right? So anyway, so he lived like that for 19 years. And he said there was the best years of his life because he was in retreat for 19 years, basically, right? He had all his texts in his head. He had all his practices in his head. He had all the scriptures. He knew all the material. He had a rosary. He was allowed the mala so he could do his prayers. But basically he said, it was like, just like being, you know, like being in old Tibet where the, you know, the lamas would go off into the caves and, you know, and spend 20 years in retreat. And he basically did that in his cousin's house, right? So he was an extraordinary man, I guess, if want of a better word. And then he left Tibet in 1985 legally. He was allowed finally to get a passport. And he came to Dharamsala. He visited His Holiness Dalai Lama. And then he started teaching at Sarah. And his teacher, who was Trijang Rinpoche, had told him that the main reason to practice Buddhism is to be of benefit to others, right? And along with oneself, of course, because if you're not of benefit to yourself, you cannot be of benefit to others. So that's a kind of a given. But nevertheless, you know, so that's what the main rationale for Buddhism. And so his teacher, Trijang Rinpoche, had told him that, you know, if you just go into retreat and just go there by yourself, then you're just benefiting yourself, right? So you're not benefiting others so much, right? So you should stay in monastery and teach, right? And so Chodron Rinpoche, when he left Tibet and he came to India, he went to Sarojay Monastery in southern India, which is where Geshe-la is from, right? And he taught for like, I don't know, 15 years, something like that, 1985, I don't know, until the late 90s, something like that. And so Geshe-la must have had teachings from him, I expect. I haven't asked him, but Geshe-la must have known him and, you know, gotten teachings from him. And so I met Rinpoche. Actually, he was my first teacher in this tradition, you know, so he has a special place in my heart. And so I met him in the late 90s because I was living in California at the time, and I was very fortunate to live near all these centers that all got all these great masters, you know, and you could have all these retreats and teachings from them. And so, and I met him even before I met Lama Zopa Rinpoche, as, you know, those of you who know Lama Zopa Rinpoche. So he gave me, you know, my lay vows many, you know, so many, 20 years ago, something like that. And, So those of us who over the years, I've continued to go to his teachings and his retreats. And when he used to come up to Vermont, you know, to Milarepa Center, even after I moved here, I would make an effort to go to his teaching. And I saw a couple of you there, actually. So those of us, his students, were really saddened. You know, really, you know, it was like losing a true father. You know, that's how we all felt. Because I've been in contact with some of them. And anyway, so what I wanted to do is kind of read to you. So that's kind of a synopsis of his life, if you will. Right? And when you came to, you know, he never said much. You know, I mean, he was quiet, really, you could almost say reserved, you know. He would laugh once in a while during his teaching. He would laugh because he remembered something, or sometimes quote unquote, he made a mistake, you know, like in his, you know, something he said, you know, he would laugh that he made a mistake, you know, like that. So, but you knew that you were in the, you just walked into the room, and when he was there, you knew that there was something different, you know, something that was very, that what nobody else had, you know, I mean, it was very interesting. And so, he had shine, right? Those of you who know shine, you know, like meditative equipoise, you know, the lam rim, the final chapter on lam, final chapter? Yeah, final chapter, meditative concentration on lam rim, the final chapter. They talk about shine, meditative concentration, where you have such mental acuity, mental power, that you can rest on any, you know, we meditate on the breath, right? You can rest on any object effortlessly, for as long as you wish, right? So for example, if you are, you know, when we put our mind to the breath, or if you're doing a meditation on the lam rim, or if you're doing a meditation on whatever, if you're doing tantric practices and you have the visualization, you know, you have to make the visualization in your mind and bring the picture to your mind and have the detail, right? He could bring the, you know, shine is when you can bring that breath or the picture or whatever into your mind effortlessly, and it's there and you never lose it. You can have it for as long as you wish, right? For those of us, of course, like me, who don't have shine, I have to kind of remember and make the picture and all this other stuff, or I have to set my mind on the breath and get down to, like all of us, right? So we were in a retreat once, on a shine retreat with Rinpoche once. I was there and a bunch of other people were there. And we asked this question, like, how long does it take? When you were at that state, how long does it take to get to that state, you know, to be conscious on the mind or on the breath or whatever? And he said, it's like that. Yeah. So he had, yeah, so anyway... But that mind is not the end, by the way. It's not the end goal. If you read the Lam Rim, you'll see that says it's not the end. That mind is not the end goal, because that is not wisdom, right? That mind is just a tool to the end goal. If you can use that mind on wisdom or on whatever the object is, then you can get there. It's like rocket fuel, Rinpoche, Ramazopa Rinpoche says, you know, it's like, you can just, it's like, because we are so distracted, it takes us forever to, like, you know, make progress, right? But when you have that mind, you can just make, cut through it all really fast. So anyway, so he was an incredible, very special person. So anyway, so I wanted to read to you the last, what his student, his attendant wrote, because it's interesting on a couple of levels. One is it's interesting to see how they conduct their lives, you know, like how, well, we can see kind of how they conduct their life, but it's interesting to see how they conduct their death, right, which we don't necessarily see a lot, right? And then it's interesting to kind of see what that, you know, what is the lesson from that, right? What can we take away from that? So that was what, that's the, anyway, so let me read it to you and then we can talk about it. So it says, it's not very long, so just be patient. It's only 2 pages. And in the middle, there might be some technical jargon, which I'll just say a couple of words about, but anyway. Dear students and friends, with great sadness, we must convey to you the news of His Eminence Chodron Rinpoche's passing into Dharma Dhatu at 1:30 a.m. on September 11th, 2015, in his labrang, that's the house at Sarah J. Monastery. As most of you know, last year in July, the glorious protector of the teachings and sentient beings, endowed with great understanding of the 5 sciences, that's medicine, craftsmanship, logic, grammar, and the inner science of Buddhism, His Eminence Chodron Rinpoche, the Supreme Jetsun Losang Gelten Jigdrum Gwangchug, manifested the state of illness from the perspective of ordinary disciples. However, through the fortunate convergence of the power of the blessing of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's compassion, the sincere request of His disciples that Rinpoche may live long and stable like a Vajra, and with meticulous medical care, the illness temporarily receded and Rinpoche was able to bestow the vast, essential, and hard-to-find teachings on profound sutra and tantra, especially the Manjushri cycle, to fortunate disciples at the main temple at Sarah J. Monastery. Now this is, so he'd been doing this for the last couple of years. I was surprised because I knew he was ill, but that's what they're talking about, is that his illness, they were able to, it was subsided because of His Holiness's prayers and his students, all of his students' prayers, etc. In recent months, due to insufficient merit of us as disciples, Rinpoche's illness reached a critical state, each day becoming progressively more severe according to the doctor. Concerned by this condition, Rinpoche's close disciples requested His Holiness Dalai Lama for an observation. Observing ominous signs, His Holiness invited Rinpoche to meet him in Delhi, because Chodron Rinpoche was too, it's a long way from Dharamshala to Delhi, it's a hard trip, so he couldn't make the trip, so he decided to meet in Delhi. On August 29th, His Holiness held a relaxed meeting with Rinpoche in his hotel room in Delhi. The following day, Rinpoche comfortably arrived at his home in the great seat of Sarah. From September 4th to 8th, together with the senior Geshes and Tulkus, Rinpoche engaged in the self-initiations of his main tantric deities, Guja Samaja, Hiruka Chakra Sampara, Yamantaka Chittamanitara, and Vajrayogini. Disciples observed that Rinpoche performed the recitations precisely without break. I've seen pictures of him at that time, like the last couple of weeks, maybe the last month, what he looked like. I'd never seen somebody that gaunt, and it was like a skeleton. You know, I mean, I've seen Rinpoche over the years, and, you know, he was young, and he was youngish, and he was, you know, he had a full body, and then he slowly, as he aged, you know, he got thinner and thinner. But when I finally saw the picture of the last month, it was amazing. So that he was able to do all these practices while he was like a skeleton. Basically, he was skin and bones, literally, right? I can't even imagine how he got out of bed. But anyway, should disciples observe the Rinpoche perform the recitations precisely without break, during that time, in accordance with the words of the texts, from the state of the single-pointed meditation, taking 3 bodies into the path, Rinpoche also performed the hand mudras without omission or redundancy. These are hand, you know, these mudras you do with your hands during these practices, right? That they symbolize various things you can see them, like, for example, Geshe-la would do them during Dharma practices and other practices. On the 8th, having completed well the rituals of self-initiation, Rinpoche showed the aspect of great contentment and gave his final instructions for the future to his disciple Geshe Gyaltun. These instructions included directions for the pujas and prayers to be done after his passing, and in the future, his advice for running of his awakening Vajra center. There are like 4 or 5 centers around the world. And indications regarding his next incarnation. Then Rinpoche requested, please bring some nice fruit juice and yogurt, and he consumed it. We think that Rinpoche was acting in accordance with the advice of past masters that for a final meal, a practitioner should take pure white food. Black foods are said to be foods that bring up, I don't want to say negative energies, but I guess it could be that, but it does distract the mind. You know, they don't work with it. You know, they make the mind more volatile or distracted and so forth and so on. So for example, in retreat, a lot of times, you know, you were supposed to eat only, you know, white foods, or when you're fasting, you only drink fruit juice, which are considered white food. So like that. So from that point onwards, Rinpoche stopped taking medicine and gross food, staying without break in profound meditation. Several times, Rinpoche requested his disciples to make extensive offerings in front of his altar. Then he would ask, please take me to the altar, and would make prayers in front of the representations of the 3 jewels. Rinpoche spent an especially long time making prayers in front of the statue of the Supreme Arya Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of Compassion. I guess, yeah, there's a tanka somewhere. Oh yeah, on the top left, there we go. That's the Buddha of Compassion, 1,000-arm chin raising. On the evening of the 10th, that's the night before he died. By the way, as you can tell, Rinpoche is choosing his time of death, right? I mean, this is not just, you know, he's kind of, I mean, this is, right? I mean, so that's kind of a, I guess the student know, you know, he's writing, the attendant is writing to us as students who know that it's a given, right? Because these beings, they don't just die, right? They choose their time of death. So that's why he knows when he's going to die. So he's basically doing all these preparations, right? On the evening of the 10th, Rinpoche sat on his throne in the full Vajra posture. That's the, you know, normal posture of meditation. And successively displayed his hands in the 2 teaching mudras. You know, that's the ones you see in the tankas where, you know, the Buddha will sit like this, or he will sit like this. You know, those are called the teaching mudras. So, his 2 teaching mudras, and successively displayed his hand in the 2 teaching mudras. Finally, he lay down in the lion's posture. So the lion's posture is the posture in which the Buddha laid down when he, at his passing, right? So you lie down on your right, left leg over right, and then with your left palm folded over right and your head up. So you'll see like Buddha's supine, when you see him in his supine posture, you'll see it like that, always on his right and so forth and so on. So that's the posture. Anyway, we'll talk about that when we go to sleep. That's the posture that's advised, etc. Okay. So finally laid out in the lion's posture. His attendant said, though lamas may display many different postures at the time of death, there is no difference in the manner of passing away. Rinpoche then calmly advised, so these are your last words, Rinpoche then calmly advised, mainly it is important to remember the kindness of the Buddha and abide in that remembrance. And added a verse from Nagarjuna's 5 stages. It says, whatever a yogi observes, he should view it like an illusion, similar to a reflection in a mirror, a dream, a mirage, a water bubble, or a trick of the eye, so should he see it. The Buddha said that that is his main insight. As he finished speaking, Rinpoche entered a state of meditation, remaining in that state at 1:30 a.m. on September 11th in his room in the Labrang, in order to inspire Towards the Dharma, his disciples, grasping at permanence, Rinpoche progressively actualized the three emptinesses and clear light, finally showing the aspect of dissolving his mind into Dharma Dhatu. All the respectful disciples will be left in a sad state on account of the news. We kindly request all, okay, then he talks about, you know, what prayers to do, and we offer sincere thanks, etc., etc. So what's interesting is to see how, you know, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, I have to start saying, when I talk, I have to say the full, I can't say Rinpoche anymore because it'll be confusing which Rinpoche I'm talking about. So Lama Zopa, he has said in the past, for example, that he meets all kinds of people at airports, you know, people, like when he stops at airports, people just stop and ask him questions and ask for advice and so forth and so on. And so he meets all kinds of people at airports and on trains, planes, automobiles. And, you know, they, you know, some of them will come up and they say, I'm not a believer. I don't, you know, and I don't believe in any of this stuff, you know, so. And what Rinpoche, Lama Zopa says is that regardless of whether you believe or not, whether you're a believer or not, everybody has one thing in common. And that is at the time of death, you have incredible fear. Okay? It's true for all of us, right? And the fear of time of death is almost insurmountable. Right, my mother, as a last night, this week my mother will have died a year ago, and I remember her death, and I saw the fear firsthand, right? So that's what, you know, and it's not a depressing thought. I mean, this is not supposed to be a depressing, you know, talk or thought, but because all of us, maybe sooner than we think, will have that experience, right? And the question is, how do we want to conduct ourselves at that time, right? Do we want to go with courage, with grace, with equanimity, you know, with, you know, all those things, or where we're struggling, we're afraid, you know, we don't want to let go with regrets, all those things that is common, right? And the reason to talk about it is because if we want to be like Rinpoche, because Rinpoche is an example, you know, the reason I read this, when I saw this in my mailbox, right, what I saw was example he sets for us as students, right? He certainly set an example for us as students when he was alive, certainly, because whatever little progress I've made, in large part, is due to him and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Geshe-la, you know, and other teachers. But also in his death, you know, he sets an example for us. And so if we want to die like him, without fear, then we have to practice in this life, right? The equanimity, the courage, the grace does not come like that, right? It's not for us, the lucky few, right? There is no such thing, by the way, in Buddhism as the lucky, right? As we know. It's because we set this causes and conditions for it, right? So if we practice in our life, if we practice a meaningful life, and we'll talk about what that means, then our death will also be graceful, right? And you could argue, well, why does it matter what our death is like? In Buddhism, of course, death is not the end, right? There is other lives that come afterward. And what Lama Zopa Rinpoche, what he has said is that you know, as you know, our karma, our actions in the past are the causes for positive results in the present or negative results in the present, right? It's a universal law in Buddhism. It's not, there's no God who punishes us or gives us rewards, but it's just our own actions that are the causes for all the results. So our future rebirths, the conditions that we are born in, whether as a human or not, whether we are in a harmonious family or work, country, community, all those things depend certainly on our actions of the past and our current actions today, right, in this life. But what Lama Zopa has also said is one of the things that affects the condition of our next life greatly is our mental state at the time of death of this life. All the other things do make, you know, all the other karmic things, you know, karmic seeds that we have created certainly has an effect on our next life. But our time, at the time of our death, the mental state has a great effect. Now, I don't know, when he said great effect, does that mean 70%, 50%, 90%? I don't know, right? But it has a great effect, right? So what that means is that if we are on a spiritual path, as if you are here in this room, I expect you are, then if we're on the spiritual path, then the spiritual path, our spiritual destiny, our spiritual goal, the path does not end with this life, right? We will continue on the spiritual path on many future lives to come. And so it's important that we set the stage for a positive life like we have in this life. We have a great, precious human life in this life. And we have great fortunes in this life right now, right? So if we want a life like this, the next life, it's important that we practice right now so that we can set the stage to be able to make spiritual progress onwards, continually onwards, right? Because if we're born as an animal in the next life, even if we're born as a pet of the greatest king, we still can't, it's hard to make spiritual progress, you know, unless the king decides to, I don't know. I know, actually, it's hard. You can figure it out. So it's important that we, you know, and the way to have a human life is to practice ethics, right? Ethical behavior is the main cause for human rebirths, right? There are many causes, you know, like, for example, patience is the cause for physical beauty. Like, if you're attractive in this life, that means that you must have practiced patience in your previous life. That's what they say. Or if you're wealthy in this life, then you probably were generous in your future, previous lives. Like that. Those, you know, so ethical behavior is the main condition for future human births. And without future human births, if you study Lamrim, you will know that human birth is the highest form of rebirth, even higher than being in the God realms. And you can see why, you can study and see why. But so it's important to be born as a human so that we can continue to make progress, because that's the only way we can gain ultimate happiness, right? So it's critical that, you know, so what is it? So that's what I was thinking of when I read about his death, about the how he died, right? Because whenever we die, it's important that we have set the stage for that, right? We have practiced for it. Right, so that when we die, we don't die with regrets and so forth. I mean, I don't know how many of you saw Jimmy Carter's press conference about a couple of months ago, you know? And you could see that there was a man who had prepared, right, for his death. So it's not that there are only these great lamas who are doing it. There are lots of people around us who are doing it, right? So we can, and the same way, we can do it too. Jimmy Carter did it through his faith and his tradition, right? And, you know, Buddhism has a way of doing it. Christianity has a way of doing it, and so forth and so on, right? So, but it's important that we set the state, you know, we do that, right? And that's what I think Rinpoche's death, about his, how he died, shows us. And it also shows that, you know, to turn the page a little bit, what did lamas, you know, so if you want to practice in this life, what does that mean? And what Lama Zopa Rinpoche has said is, you must have a meaningful life. What does it mean to have a meaningful life? And Rinpoche, when I say Rinpoche now, I mean Lama Zopa Rinpoche, because I'm not going to talk about Chön Rinpoche all that much anymore. So what Rinpoche said, it's a life that's spent with the primary motivation of benefiting others. That is a meaningful life. And the reason is that the opposite of that, which is a self-cherishing life or a self-cherishing mind, he has said, is the main obstacle to all of us. I'm sorry, is a cause for all of our obstacles. The self-cherishing mind is a cause for all our obstacles. Okay? Whether it's obstacles at work, whether it's obstacles in our family, whether it's obstacles, you know what they are. Each of us has our own sets of obstacles in our lives, right? And the self-cherishing mind, which only thinks of oneself, is the main cause for that. If we can remove the self-cherishing mind, which means that our motivation is thinking about others, then obstacles will also disappear. Not overnight, of course, because we've created the causes in the previous life, so that's hard to remove. You could purify, I guess. But at least in the future, you won't have obstacles, right? Because we think that, you know, so it's counterintuitive. If we want happiness, we should work for the happiness of others. That's basically what Rinpoche said. He said, make that your heart practice. That's what he said. If you do nothing else, you don't have to do prayers, you don't have to do prostrations, you don't have to do pujas, you don't have to do any of that, right? At least work with the motivation or work, whatever you're doing, have the motivation that you're benefiting others. As I said, of course, that does not mean don't benefit oneself, because you have to, you know, we have to benefit, you know, when he says benefiting others, it doesn't mean just become a doormat and just, you know, let others walk all over you. That's not what he's talking about. But he's talking about we have a strong center, and from that we benefit others, right? We have to have that to first place, right? So we have to work on ourselves, and in the process, we work work for others, right? So, and if we can remove that, and the benefiting others works in, I gotta stop soon, but benefiting others works in two ways, right? So the one thing is that it, as I said, it's the antidote to the self-cherishing mind. So it removes obstacles that are in our way, obstacles to our spiritual progress, you know? Because there are lots of people, you know, I was reading Chön Rinpoche himself, I was reading something by Chön Rinpoche, couple of days ago, he wrote in many years ago, and he said there are people who go meditate for 30 years, 40 years, dozen years, don't make progress. You know, they're all, you know, they don't make progress. Why? There's some obstacles, you know. Those obstacles, that's because of self-cherishing mind. Just because you go meditate does not mean you're going to make progress. So benefiting others is an antidote to our self-cherishing mind, which removes obstacles. Benefiting others also has another the other side of it, which is that it actually creates the causes for positive results in the future. So if we want happiness in the future for us and others, we first have to remove obstacles, and second, we have to create the causes for that happiness. And for both of that, we have to work for benefiting others. Because it's the opposite of self-cherishing mind. Because self-cherishing mind gives you exactly the opposite of what we want. We think if we work for ourselves, we will bring happiness. Right? Whether it's for our job, whether it's for whatever it is, right? So that's what Lama Zopa Rinpoche said about how to live a meaningful life. You know, and if we can live a meaningful life, then, well, I guess the sky's the limit. We can have a meaningful death, certainly, but we can also, you know, but we can attain all of our goals, right? And those goals, of course, when in the Lam Rim, for example, when they say you attain your goals, the goals are not about the goals of this life. It's the goals are not about, you know, just about, you know, having a nice life, get to golf when we retire, all those things, right? Because those are transient. Those are happinesses that are transient, right? They last for a while, and then they're gone. Either they're gone because we don't have money to keep those habits going, or we're gone because we die. One of the two, right? So they're transient. But when they talk about attaining our goals, they're talking about our ultimate goals, which means a happiness that is permanent, that is not transient, right? That does not go away, that does not depend on causes and conditions. So that's why, you know, so I was kind of back, you know, that's what I was thinking. Rinpoche's death, what does that mean? I was backtracking, right? So what does it mean in my life, and how can I be like him? Right? Because, and it's important for us, all of us, to see these teachers, like Geshe-la, for example. Like Geshe-la is we're very fortunate to have such a qualified teacher, right? Geshe-la is a qualified teacher. It's important that we see him as that example, that he sets the example with his humility, with his patience. He has to have great patience to continually teach us. And all those things. And so we have to cultivate our relationships with our teachers. We have to be able to see them as such, that they're examples for us. That they are kind of blazing the trail, if you will, that we can follow. Because then we can follow a well-trodden path, right? It becomes easier for us, right? That's why they're here. All the teachers, that's why the because Geshe-la does not, by the way, Geshe-la does not, forget about Chodron Rinpoche, who grew up as an incarnation and he so forth and so on, but Geshe-la, he doesn't have to be here. You know, Geshe-la could go back to Sarajevo. He's got his students there. He could live just fine. He could go to retreat. He could just, you know, he doesn't have to be here. He's here because he is able to be of benefit to us, right? That's the only reason he's here. He's not here because he has a house. He's not here because he has a car. He's not here because, you know, gets to come to the center, you know? So it's important for us, if we want to make progress through our lives, to cultivate relationships with teachers. Now, I'm not saying they have to be Buddhist teachers, right? But some teachers for whom we have respect, for whom we can see that they're qualified. It's important to have qualified teachers. And who can lead us down the correct path, right? And so Chodron Rinpoche was like that for me, along with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you know, along with the others, few others. And so, and it's important to continue to cultivate that relationship, right, while they're alive, right, and certainly after they have passed, you know, through, you know, there are many ways to do that, but in any case, remembering them, like Chodron Rinpoche said at the end, it's important to remember, you know, to Buddha and his remembrance, right? When he says Buddha, he also means his teachers, right? Like that. So that we can continue to meet them in future lives. Just because you're born a human, if we're fortunate enough to be born a human in the next life, it's not guaranteed that we're going to make spiritual progress. We're again going to need a teacher, right? And how are we going to get a teacher? Is if we have created a karmic connection with a teacher in our current life or past lives, right? Because we travel in packs in a way. You know, we kind of like, we create karmic connections with each of us, our friends, our family, and we kind of, you can read in the Lam Rim, there's stories about this, you know, like, there's one about where, anyway, I won't go into it, increase the time. So we have to create the connection with them, we have to cultivate the connection, we have to water it and fertilize it and all that stuff. So that, you know, we can make progress. So that's why, you know, it's, so anyway. So, if you want to know more about how to have a meaningful life and to have the compassionate attitude, there's a wonderful book by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. I think it's even free, if I'm not mistaken. I hope I'm not mistaken. It's called The Bodhisattva Attitude. It's in the... Is it free? Well, there you go. You can't lose. It's a donation. Okay. Yes, okay. So, it's in the bookstore. You know, it's Lama Zopa Rinpoche's condensation of his teachings over many retreats. And, you know, and it talks about how to throughout the day. But I'll just give you a... Oh, sorry, Donna.
That's okay.
1 minute. So, the only thing I would say is what Lama Zopa Rinpoche has told all of us as students how to... the basics of how to have practice a meaningful life, right? He said, the most important thing, of course, is the motivation, right? It's not the action that makes it good or bad. It's the motivation behind the action, right? That's always the case. So he said that when you get up in the morning, the first thing you do as you get out of bed, you think, how wonderful I have another day, right? Because that's not guaranteed. The second thing you think, he suggested us to think, is whatever I do today, may it only be for the benefit of others. Right? So we set that motivation. Maybe we can live up to it. Maybe we can't because we're human. You know, we make mistakes. But, as one great master said, every great thing starts at the tip of a wish. Right? Every great, you know, result starts at the tip of a wish. So if we don't have the wish, we're not going to even have a chance of making it. At least if we have the wish, we have some chance. And then we can build on that chance, right? So that's why he says, second thing you think is, may I be of benefit to others. Whatever I do today, may I be of benefit to others. And then throughout the day, whenever you're doing anything, you can think about how I can be of benefit. So, for example, in the Bodhisattva Attitude book, he talks about if you're drinking your tea or coffee, you can offer it to the Buddhas or your teachers or to all the people who are suffering in this world right now, you know, who are thirsty, like that, right? It's the attitude, again, that matters, right? Or if you're washing your dishes, you can think, with this washing, I'm removing the stains and dirt from my mind, my delusions, right? And may all beings everywhere the same way remove their stains, right? And they're all kind of like this, little things that are reminders, right? Or one of the great things is when you're walking, for example, you can think all the Buddhas, the statues, the scriptures, the stupas, all, you know, all the teachers are all on your right. That way, you're always circumambulating, right? And all the beings are behind you so that you're leading them. Right, so we're all traveling down the same path, right? So like that, we can change the way we think about every action that we take, action of body, speech, and mind, by the way. All thoughts as well have, you know, are also actions. So we can transform our entire day into virtue, which is the cause for a future human birth, which is the cause for continual spiritual progress, so forth and so on, right? And then finally, at the end of the day, we think through our day, and if we've done things that are positive, rejoice. Pat ourselves on the back, rejoice, and may we do it again tomorrow, right? And of course, there are going to be things that we're not so proud of. We engender great regret, right? I'm really sorry I did that, right? And also at the same time, we make a resolution that we won't do it for some reasonable period of time. So the reasonable period is something that we can keep, a promise that we can keep, right? There's no point in saying I'm not going to do it again because that's not going to happen. So you say, if it's something that we do every week, then we say, okay, my reasonable period of time is 2 weeks. I won't do it for 2 weeks. If it's something we do every day, then I won't do it for 2 days, right? Like that, some reasonable period of time. That way, we are continually decreasing the amount of non-virtue. So with the rejoicing, we create the causes for increasing the amount of virtue we're continually doing. And with the resolution and regret, we are trying to decrease the amount of non-virtue. So we work both ways, right? And those of you who know the Vajrasattva practice, you can of course do that, right? So that's kind of in a nutshell what Lama Zopa Rinpoche's instructions were to have a meaningful life, right? And I encourage you to read that book. You know, it's wonderful. You can get it on Kindle too. There you go. So there's no excuse now. And I also urge you, encourage you, that when the great masters come, like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, actually, I encourage and urge you to come to Geshe-la's teachings, first of all, right? To follow his teachings. The greatest gift one can give to a teacher is to follow his teachings. Not offerings, not prostrations, not any of those things, but the teachings, right? So come to Geshe-la's teachings and follow his instructions. And when Rinpoche comes next year, because Rinpoche is also getting old and he's manifesting illnesses, right? Which is his way of showing us that it's not permanent either, right? We think he's going to be around forever. So it's important that while he's here, that we make the effort, right? So when he comes next year in September, I encourage you to go to his teachings. August now, okay. August, I encourage you to go to his teachings, his retreat, make whatever you can do, you know, so that you can make that relation, create that relationship. And if you've already created it, cultivate it, right? Okay. I'm going to stop here. Let's do our prayers, and then Donna wanted me to finish early. That didn't work. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Thank you. Okay. Page 37, Chen Reisig's mind. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to do the dedication prayers on page 36. 36. And the short life, and then we'll do the mantras at the bottom of 37. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel Bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow. And may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chen Reisig Tenjin Gatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as a bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And then we'll do seven Tara mantras for Geshe-la's long, happy life. Again, if somebody can start it.
Tu tare tu re so ha. Om tare 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 tu tare tu re so. Om tare tu tare tu re so.
Thank you very much.